Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to be talking about cranberries as the new antibiotic. That's from Boston University School of Medicine. The power of blueberries. From the journal Free Radical Biology and Medicine, some really exciting things about those little purple pigments that can make a difference, and how using copper to prevent the spread of respiratory viruses, University of Southampton, United Kingdom. We're talking about saving your life from some severe acute respiratory syndrome like SARS and the Middle Eastern respiratory syndrome MERS, all because of this animal coronavirus that is jumping to humans. How's it get there? How about on the surfaces? What surfaces? The surfaces of everything. Countertops. Yeah, doorknobs. Even in a movie theater, the armrests. So we'll talk about that. Also, finally, they're catching up. Vitamin C and its impact upon cancer. I began a discussion of this yesterday from a study. Well, we have more studies showing vitamin C mitigates in the war on cancer. Also today, after watching the debates, which were, well, you would be getting about as much relevance if you read an edition of Mad Magazine, I want to talk about the truth behind Benghazi. And it's not me who's going to say this. Rather, it's 60 Minutes, a report from 60 Minutes, that we play part of. So Benghazi was not a fake scandal, as the Democrats would like us to believe. So someone at CBS Network had the courage to do a really good original investigative reporting job. So that's part of the story. But then why? Why cover up Benghazi? Why hide the truth? What was behind it? We'll have then on Larry Hancock. Larry is regarded as one of the foremost independent investigative researchers in the areas of U.S. intelligence and the national security state. He's written on the history of the CIA, political assassinations, religious extremism and terrorism, and the murder of Martin Luther King. Larry's research has been endorsed by the former House Select Committee of Investigation staff and the former historian for the State Department and the CIA. So he's extraordinarily credible. And he will be talking about what was behind Benghazi. Why does everybody, Democrat and Republican, want to cover it up? We'll share that with you, and that'll follow the 60 Minutes. You're going to get two pieces of the puzzle today and a different look at the Hillary Clinton tenure at the State Department in particular. So we have an exciting program lined up. Let's begin. First off, cranberries, everyone who's into health knows that cranberries, eaten fresh, which is rare because they're seasonal, or cranberries eaten sun-dried, that's easy to do. You can buy them in almost any health food store or major supermarket. Cranberry juice unsweetened, that's good, but cranberry concentrate, that's the best of all. That means no sugar. They wick out or reduce the water content of the juice so it becomes more concentrated in the healing nutrients called polyphenols and phytonutrients. Here's what it can do. This is from the Boston University School of Medicine, and I will quote it verbatim. It says, quote, "While the world scrambles to find newer and more powerful antibiotics to combat antibiotic-resistant bacteria, researchers reported at the International Conference of Polyphenols and Health that evidence that cranberries can be used to combat recurrent urinary tract infections and more. Quote, we have long believed in the urinary tract health benefits that cranberries provide, but this new research reveals just how wide-ranging those benefits can be. And that is according to Dr. Gupta, MD, Chief of Infectious Disease and Professor of Medicine at Boston University School of Medicine. So they have found that it really is a great natural antibiotic. And that means that it can improve everything from blood flow that could aid the cardiovascular system and the brain. Quote, based upon emerging science, cranberries can be a vital nutrient asset to additional health, particularly in the areas of, for example, the heart. So let's take a look at this and summarize. If you were to include cranberries, cranberry powder, cranberry concentrate, or cranberry juice, that's your three best, you could help reduce infections in your body that have bacteria as a part of them, which is a lot of infections, candida overgrowth, urinary tract infection, bladder infections, and help your heart. So that's one good reason to use it. But then there's another reason to use berries. And we're going to look for a moment at blueberries. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Free Radical Biology and Medicine. Blueberries, of course, are among the few blue foods found in nature. They owe their color as well as their health benefits to what are called antho, A-N-T-H-O, cyanidins, C-Y-A-N-I-N, anthocyanidins. Now, the anthocyanidins are plant pigments that give them their color, but they're also rich in antibacterial, anti-cancer, anti-diabetic, and antioxidant properties. So they're terrific for people who are overweight, who have pre or existing diabetes, and now they're shown to be good for your brain. How so? Well, what we have found is that the anthocyanidin and flavonoids that you find in blueberries, but also green tea and chocolate, the cocoa, you have two words, coca and cacao. They're both coming from the indigenous chocolate plant, and that's what makes them the pods, and that's what makes them so beneficial. They're both the same. But anyhow, blueberries are really high part of that, and they are neuroprotective proteins in the brain. That means that when you take your blueberries fresh, that's good. Blueberry juice, that's great. Blueberry concentrate, even better. Blueberry power, best of all. You're protecting the connections between neurons. You're improving cerebral blood flow. You're producing new brain cells. In fact, a study examining Alzheimer's disease, mice supplemented with blueberries performed better in a maze test indicating an improvement in memory. Another study conducted with rats found that blueberries consumed prior to a simulated stroke resulted in less brain damage compared to a control group. The authors conclude that the consumption of blueberries could help improve stroke outcomes. So, blueberries for the brain, blueberries for your eyes, for vision. In fact, in a study of older adults, 12 weeks of drinking blueberry juice resulted in improved learning, better wordless recall, accompanied by a trend towards lower glucose levels and reduction in depression symptoms. So a long-term study, a separate study, uncovered an association between increased blueberry intake and a slower rate of cognitive decline in 16,000 participants. The authors of the report estimate blueberry intakes delayed cognition by 2.5 years. And in addition to helping memory and learning in older individuals, blueberries can boost these facilities in younger people. In fact, a recent study involving children between the ages of 8 and 10 found improvement in memory after having a blueberry drink. So it can also help the hippocampus, hippo, H-I-P-P-O, campus, C-A-M-P-U-S, hippocampus. That's an area of the brain that forms memories, and blueberries does that. So it's one of our super foods. I want to make sure the people in this audience use it. All the berries are good. So for those of you who are having your berry shake each day, either fresh berries, organic, wash them if they're not. Use some, you can use hydrogen peroxide. You can use apple cider vinegar, diluted in water, agitate them, rinse them thoroughly. A veggie wash, spray your fruits if they're not organic and then wash them. Or you can use the juice or the powder. But as long as you're getting your mixed berries every day, wow, are you doing a good benefit for your brain. And finally, from the University of Milan in Italy, wine extract shows gastro benefits in vitro, quote from the study. A standardized wine extract can deliver raised levels of procyanidins, antioxidants, and improve gastrointestinal well-being, researchers in Milan have found. Why? It's the polyphenols. It's those wonderful chemicals that you found in grapes and berries. You also find it in wine. And this was done at the Department of Pharmacological and Biomedical Biomolecular Science, University of Milan, and published in a peer-reviewed journal. So, those who have been drinking wine, preferably, I would suggest, non-alcoholic red wine, you're getting a benefit, tremendous benefit. Those of you who have a glass of grape juice, you're getting about 100 times more benefit. So it's in the grape, and it's good for you, and that helps with digestion. Oh, I mentioned copper. Let me just share this with you. Anytime I'm out in public, if I go to a restaurant, I always put a napkin on my seat before I sit down. I then put another napkin on the table. Why? People look at you and think you're eccentric. That's fine. Don't have a problem with that. And when I get in a cab, I put a paper bag, and then I sit on the paper bag. Why? Because as a scientist, I was one of the first to do a study. There were others who published the results. I didn't publish the results of some of these because I was just curious. I wanted to know why so many people were getting sick downstairs. I was on the third floor, but most of the scientists were on the first floor. And there was a two-week period where everyone seemed to be sick. We went into a toilet. There was only one restroom there, and we coated the entire restroom. There was a bacteriologist and virologist, and we coated it in an agar. So every inch was like a petri dish. And then one person went in, unknown, but they would then put it was a sign saying, in use. 20 minutes after that in use sign, the person used the toilet, we went in, and there was a machine that one of the bacteriologists has that they scan it, and it counted off how many bacteria. There was somewhere in the neighborhood of 400,000 bacteria and thousands of virus from one single person using that toilet one time with the toilet seat raised up. I remember at the time saying, my goodness, there's your cause. When people go into a bathroom, they're touching doorknobs and water knobs and faucets. They're touching walls. They're touching the toilet seat to put it up or down. They're touching the plunger that plunges and the water goes out of the basin, flushes it down. But what's really happening is, as that water comes gushing down, it's hitting whatever mass of feces is in the toilet, causing, in effect, the toilet to sneeze. Now imagine in airports where they have no toilet seats, movie theaters where they frequently don't have toilet seats, meaning they'll have a seat, but they don't have a cover coming down on it. So it's always open. So every time it's used, it's putting thousands, hundreds of thousands, and by accumulation, millions, hundreds of millions of bacteria and viruses into the air, lands on surfaces. Same way in a home. It's landing on your soap, your toothbrush, your water glass, your knobs, everything. So by simply putting a toilet lid down, you're helping protect yourself from that. But then you go into a hospital and you're seeing someone, they're in bed, they have an infection, and as long as you're sitting in the chair, you're thinking you're okay. Not true. And in comes copper. Just like you don't know if someone sitting in the chair has feces on their pants. And by the way, this is really gross, but it's important you see this. A recent study showed that virtually every single seat in a movie theater had feces on them. But if you looked at the seat, you couldn't see it. Well, how in the world could movie theater seats have feces? Simply because in America, we lack hygiene. We wipe, we don't wash. properly cleansing yourself means that after you defecate, you should use soap and water and wash yourself. Unless you're in a place where you can't, then you should use some form of clean wipe. And again, I wouldn't use a chemical because that chemical can migrate into the body. You want something that's alcohol-free and using ingredients that will kill germs. And that's the key. You want to kill the germs with some form of natural sanitation. And there are a lot of different products on the market that could help you do that. So, you know, that's what I suggest. But one way or the other, always clean, and don't just wipe, because wiping just smears it around. It's like the people that pick up a fruit, like an apple, and wipe it on their shirt or pants. You haven't taken away any bacteria. You've simply smeared it. You've made it more likely to get even more contamination. So when I'm putting something on a seat, I don't want that feces on my body, on my clothes. And I don't want to sit at a table where someone may have sneezed and had hepatitis or have herpes. So I simply exercise a little bit of precaution. Here's the latest on this, and this is from the University of Southampton, United Kingdom. I'll quote it verbatim. And this was presented and published before the Journal of the American Society of Microbiologists. So this is now official science. Quote, new research in the University of Southampton has found that copper can effectively help to prevent the spread of respiratory viruses, which are linked to severe acute respiratory syndrome, SARS, and Middle Eastern respiratory infection, MERS. Animal coronaviruses that host jump to humans, such as SARS and MERS, result in severe infections and high death. The Southampton researchers found that a closely related human coronavirus, 229E, can remain infectious on common surface materials for several days, but it is rapidly destroyed on copper. In a newly published paper in MBio, Journal of the American Society of Microbiology, reports that human coronavirus 229E, which produces a range of respiratory symptoms from the common cold to more lethal outcomes such as pneumonia, can survive on surface materials including ceramic tiles, glass, rubber, and stainless steel for at least 5 days. While human-to-human transmission is important, infections can be contracted by touching surfaces contaminated by respiratory droplets from infected individuals or hand-touching, leading to a wider and more rapid spread. On copper, in a range of copper alloys, collectively termed antimicrobial copper, the coronavirus was rapidly inactivated within a few minutes from simulated fingertip contamination. Exposure to copper destroyed the virus completely and irreversibly, leading the researchers to conclude that antimicrobial copper surfaces could be employed in communal areas and at any mass gatherings to help reduce the spread of respiratory viruses and protect public health. Quote, from lead researchers Dr. Sarah Warrens, transmission of infectious diseases via contaminated surfaces is far more important than was originally thought, and this includes viruses that can cause respiratory infections. This is especially important when the infectious dose is low and just a few virus particles can initiate an infection. So, okay. So you mean all those decades at the Institute of Applied Biology, where as a senior research fellow scientist, where everyone else laughed and thought it was, well, Gary's being Gary, kind of eccentric, not kind of, very, making sure that he goes around and sprays that colloidal silver and antibacterial in that solution. How stupid is that? No, wasn't stupid. And when you go in to see someone in a hospital, you take the same thing and just wipe down the surface areas that you're going to be sitting in, touching. Not stupid. And in the restaurant, I had copper hood. I had copper counters in the kitchen. Therefore, no infections on the food. Not stupid. So now you see, don't look at what other people are unaware of as what should guide you. Look at what you know from your own research and experience can help you. I'll hold my report on intravenous vitamin C, stopping the growth of aggressive forms of cancer, for tomorrow's program. I have two reports on vitamin C and cancer for tomorrow. And we're going to take a brief break and come back and go into a discussion on Benghazi with a report from 60 Minutes, a partial report, a news report, and then from there we will take it further. But I just want to take a moment and say hello to Verne, that's V-E-R-N-E, Verona. He's on hold right now. And I just hired Verne. As I've been mentioning, I'm hiring and still am interviewing some people who can help people who have health issues, guide them through the changes they need with lifestyle and behavior modification. And I help people who are the terminally ill, meaning you have to have a letter from your physician showing you that there is nothing else medicine can do, that there's nothing, you're going home to die. That's when I go to work. So everyone else who has, you know, is overweight and wants to lose weight, who doesn't know how to shop healthy because they're used to shopping by impulse for foods that are almost always universally unhealthy, I've hired people who've helped tens of thousands. Remember, we had Dr. Nadia, a great behavioralist, who helped thousands of people. She's doing, by the way, her third and final postdoctoral fellowship. And she has her hours now for board certification. So I'm glad to see in the last year and a half, she has helped herself to get to the next stage in her own career. She'll be a great person in helping heal when she finally gets this all done in another couple months. In any case, Pat Duncanson, great person helping people, and she worked with us for years. So now I can use a couple more people because there are thousands of people who want help, and I can't help them all. It's just not possible. So I do this as a public service. I pay them a very good living wage so that you can get their service for free. All you do is you call, and they'll set an appointment. You must see them in person. So Verne is on the phone now. Hi, Verne.
Hi, Gary. Thanks for the call.
I just wanted people to know a little bit about you. Tell us a little bit about yourself so people can get an idea about what you are about, what do you do to help people from your background?
Thank you. Well, I started in the early 70s, Gary, with Chinese medicine. And I went to a Chinese medical course for 4 years and studied all aspects of that. And then I learned to go out and make it more multicultural. And that's kind of what I do today. I teach people how body, mind, and spirit all work together using nutrition as a basement, as a substructure to really build your health on. I've written a couple of different books. My most popular book is Nature's Cancer Fighting Foods by Parajit Putnam. And it's really on how to enhance immunity so that our bodies can learn to fight. Another book I have is the Macrobiotics Book for Dummies. I took that concept of macrobiotics, meaning large view, and made it a little more North American, a little more multicultural, a little more flexible, and that's what I do. I had a practice in Los Angeles for many years in a medical facility I started with two physician friends, and since abandoned it, and returned to New York, and where I'm writing and helping Gary Null. So here I am. And I'm glad to be at the store. It's been kind of fun to meet people in the afternoons there. So if anybody has a concern and they need some extra support, come see us personally, and we can lay out some kind of practical program for you, and we can go from there.
Good. Now, Verne is there to help guide people into making healthier lifestyle choices, and he has a really very deep and rich background. He also is the director and writer of an important documentary. I just saw the trailer the other day. It was shot in Hawaii with a holistic barefoot doctor, a very famous MD, who was a professor out there, on how they took a group of people for a short period of time, I think a month, and had them change their lifestyle to become vegans and a plant-based diet, and how that reversed a lot of diseases. And I'm looking forward to being able to share that with our audience at some point in the future. So if you'd like help, call 212-874-4000, 212-874-4000. And you've got Larry, you've got Celestina, and now you also have Verne, V-E-R-N-E. Thank you, Verne.
Thank you.
And let's now go over and say, and by the way, he is a vegan, healthy athlete, and so I hire the people who talk it and walk it. And again, any counseling he does, it's free. Now let's say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. I think we wanted to go over today and talk a little bit about your upcoming retreat in January.
Yes. This is going to be an enjoyable retreat. We're doing this to help our station, Progressive Radio Network. This is not for WBAI. This is for Progressive Radio, which is a different audience. And we're looking to help people in 1 week to really change their attitudes about themselves, to empower themselves, to take their hero's journey, to let go of fear and anger and pain and trauma, to embrace a sense of their own completeness and be around people who are examples of that, with a healthy diet, with juicing, with exercise, power walking, jogging, biking, swimming, water aerobics, yoga, meditation, a lot of interesting, even we have a new person who's helping us for the first time, do dance and improvisation, wonderful mix of yoga, dance, singing. We haven't done that before, all in one session for those who want to try that. But then again, no one had ever done art as healing until we did it with Elaine Ryan, who did a great job at it. So we're adding new things into the mix, cooking, and a whole discussion on hydroponics and organic homesteading. So it's going to be a filled week, great weather, great staff, a whole lot of new staff, and that will be for 1 week. And if people want to join us, give Luann a call. Luann?
Yes, call me at 631-504-6198. That's 631-504-6198. And this will be towards the end of January.
Good. Okay. Give your number one more time.
Surely. 631-504-6198. I'll go over all the details with you.
And we limit the number of people who can come. They're always full. And we have major transformations in people's lives. I mean major transformation. It's just not about going up to the Catskills and doing meditation for a week or going someplace and doing some yoga. It's about changing your life, starting the new year with a positive attitude and not bringing fear, failed relationships, a crisis in your life, into another day in your life. There's no more need for that. And a whole lot of new lectures. I'll be lecturing every night, and Luann will be counseling every day. That's all inclusive. Good. Thank you, Luann. Again, give your number one more time.
631-504-6198. 631-504-6198.
And that will be in towards the end of January, our health retreat. Now, we're going to take a brief break, a music break, come back, and we're going to go right from that break right into, so you know what you're listening to, you're going right into a 60 Minutes report on Benghazi. It talks about this is not a fake scandal, it's a real scandal. That's part one, and then part two will be our guest who will be standing by, who will comment upon it and give you the second part that no one in the media has discussed. Please stay with us.
When Chris Stevens was killed in Benghazi, Libya, on the anniversary of September 11th last year, it was only the sixth time that the United States had lost an ambassador to its enemies. The events of that night have been overshadowed by misinformation, confusion, and intense partisanship. But for those who lived through it, there's nothing confusing about what happened. And they share a sense of profound frustration because they say they saw it coming. Tonight, you'll hear for the first time from a security officer who witnessed the attack. He calls himself Morgan Jones, a pseudonym he's using for his own safety. A former British soldier, he's been helping to keep U.S. diplomats and military leaders safe for the last decade. On a night he describes as sheer hell, Morgan Jones snuck into a Benghazi hospital that was under the control of Al-Qaeda terrorists, desperate to find out if one of his close friends from the U.S. special mission was the American he had been told was there.
The story will continue in a moment.
I was dreading seeing who it was, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It didn't take long to get to the room, and I could see in through the glass. And I didn't even have to go into the room to see who it was. I knew who it was immediately.
Who was it?
It was the ambassador. He was dead. Yeah, shocking.
Morgan Jones said he'd never felt so angry in his life. Only hours earlier, Ambassador Chris Stevens had sought him out, concerned about the security at the U.S. Special Mission compound, where Morgan was in charge of the Libyan Guard Force. Now the ambassador was dead, and the U.S. compound was engulfed in flames and overrun by dozens of heavily armed fighters. Although the attack began here, the more organized assault unfolded about a mile across the city at a top-secret CIA facility known as the Annex. It lasted more than 7 hours and took 4 American lives.
We do not have any indication at this point of premeditation or pre-planned attacks. But it is
contrary to the White House's public statements, which were still being made a full week later. It's now well established that the Americans were attacked by Al-Qaeda in a well-planned assault. 5 months before that night, Morgan Jones first arrived in Benghazi, in eastern Libya, about 400 miles from the capital, Tripoli. He thought this would be an easy assignment compared to Afghanistan and Iraq. But on his first drive through Benghazi, he noticed the black flags of Al-Qaeda flying openly in the streets. And he grew concerned about the guard force as soon as he pulled up to the U.S. compound.
There was nobody there that we could see. And then we realized they were all inside drinking tea, laughing and joking. Then
what did you think?
Instantly, I thought we're going to have to get rid of all these guys.
Morgan Jones's job was training the unarmed guards who manned the compound's gates. A second Libyan force, an armed militia hired by the State Department, was supposed to defend the compound in the event of an attack. Morgan had nothing to do with the militia, but they worried him so much he could not keep quiet.
Because I was saying, these guys are no good, you need to get them out of here.
You also kept saying, if this place is attacked, these guys are not going to stand and fight.
Yeah, I used to say it all the time. In the end, I got quite bored of hearing my own voice saying it.
We have one option. Leave Benghazi or you will be killed.
Green Beret Commander Lieutenant Colonel Andy Wood was one of the top American security officials in Libya. Based in Tripoli, he met with Ambassador Stevens every day. The last time he went to Benghazi was in June, just 3 months before the attack. While he was there, Al-Qaeda tried to assassinate the British ambassador. Wood says to him it came as no surprise because Al-Qaeda, using a familiar tactic, had stated their intent in an online posting, saying they would attack the Red Cross, the British, and then the Americans in Benghazi.
And you watched as they attacked
as they did,
the Red Cross and the British mission, and the only ones left
were us. They made good on 2 out of the 3 promises. It was a matter of time till they captured the third one.
And Washington was aware of that?
They knew, we monitored it. We included that in our reports to both State Department and DOD.
Andy Wood told us he raised his concerns directly with Ambassador Stevens 3 months before the U.S. compound was overrun.
I made it known in a country team meeting, you are going to get attacked. You are going to get attacked in Benghazi. It's going to happen. You need to change your security profile.
Shut down the special
mission. Shut down operations. Move out temporarily or change locations within the city. Do something to break up the profile because you are being targeted. They're watching you. The attack cycle is such that they're in their final planning stages.
Wait a minute. You said they're in the final planning stages of an attack on the American mission in Benghazi.
It was apparent to me that that was the case.
Reading
all these other attacks that were occurring, I could see what they were staging up to. It was obvious.
We have learned the U.S. already knew that this man, senior al-Qaeda leader Abu Anas al-Libi, was in Libya, tasked by the head of al-Qaeda to establish a clandestine terrorist network inside the country. Al-Libi was already wanted for his role in bombing two U.S. embassies in Africa.
It was a frightening piece of information.
Because it meant what?
It raised the stakes, changed the game.
Greg Hicks, who testified before Congress earlier this year, was Ambassador Stevens' deputy, based in Tripoli, a 22-year veteran of the Foreign Service with an impeccable reputation.
And in that environment, you were asking for more security assets and you were not getting them.
That's right.
Did you fight that?
I was in the process of trying to frame a third request, but it was not allowed to go forward.
So why didn't you get the help that you needed and that you asked for?
I really, really don't know. I, in fact, would like to know that, the answer to that question.
In the months prior to the attack, Ambassador Stevens approved a series of detailed cables to Washington, specifically mentioning, among other things, the al-Qaeda flag has been spotted several times, flying over government buildings. When the attack began on the evening of September 11th, Ambassador Stevens immediately called Greg Hicks, who was back in Tripoli.
Ambassador said that the consulate's under attack, and then the line cut.
Do you remember the sound of his voice?
Oh, yeah. It's indelibly imprinted on my mind.
How did he sound?
He sounded frightened.
In Benghazi, Morgan Jones, who was at his apartment about 15 minutes away, got a frantic call from one of his Libyan guards.
I could hear gunshots. And he said, there's men coming into the mission. His voice, he was scared. He could tell he was really scared. And he was running. I could tell he was running.
His first thought was for his American friends, the State Department agents who were pinned down inside the compound. And he couldn't believe it when one of them answered his phone.
I said, what's going on? He said, we're getting attacked. And I said, how many? And he said, they're all over the compound. And I was shocked. I didn't know what to say. And I said, well, just keep fighting. I'm on my way.
Morgan's guards told him the armed Libyan militia that was supposed to defend the compound had fled, just as Morgan had predicted. His guards, unarmed and terrified, sounded the alarm, but they were instantly overwhelmed by the attackers.
They said, we're here to kill Americans, not Libyans. So they give them a good beating. Pistol whipped them, beat them with their rifles, and let them go.
We're here to kill Americans.
That's what they said, yeah.
Not Libyans.
Yeah.
About 30 minutes into the attack, a quick reaction force from the CIA annex ignored orders to wait and raced to the compound, at times running and shooting their way through the streets just to get there. Inside the compound, they repelled a force of as many as 60 armed terrorists and managed to save 5 American lives and recover the body of Foreign Service officer Sean Smith. They were forced to fight their way out before they could find the ambassador. Not long afterwards, Morgan Jones scaled the 12-foot-high wall of the compound that was still overrun with al-Qaeda fighters.
One guy saw me. He just shouted. I couldn't believe that he'd seen me because it was so dark. He started walking towards me.
And as he was coming closer?
As I got closer, I just hit him with the butt of the rifle in the face.
And?
Oh, he went down, yeah.
He dropped?
Yeah, like a stone.
With his face smashed in?
Mm, yeah.
And no one saw you do it?
No.
Or heard it?
No, there was too much noise.
The same force that had gone to the compound was now defending the CIA annex. Hours later, they were joined by a small team of Americans from Tripoli. From defensive positions on these rooftops, the Americans fought back a professional enemy. In a final wave of intense fighting, just after 5 a.m., the attackers unleashed a barrage of mortars. Three of them slammed into this roof, killing former Navy SEALs Tyrone Woods and Glenn Doherty.
They hit that roof three times.
They hit those roofs three times.
In the dark.
Yeah, that's getting the basketball through the hoop over your shoulder.
What does it take to pull off an attack like that?
Coordination, planning, training, experienced personnel. They practiced those things. They knew what they were doing. That was a well-executed attack.
We have learned that there were two Delta Force operators who fought at the annex, and they've since been awarded the Distinguished Service Cross and the Navy Cross, two of the military's highest honors. The Americans who rushed to help that night went without asking for permission, and the lingering question is why no larger military response ever crossed the border into Libya. Something Greg Hicks realized wasn't going to happen just an hour into the attack.
You have this conversation with the defense attaché. You ask him what military assets are on their way, and he says,
effectively, they're not. And I, for a moment, I just felt lost. I just couldn't believe the answer. And then I made the call to the annex chief. I told him, listen, you've got to tell those guys there may not be any help coming.
That's a tough thing to understand. Why?
It just is. For the people that go out onto the edge to represent our country, we believe that if we get in trouble, they're coming to get us. That our back is covered. To hear that it's not, it's a terrible, terrible experience.
The U.S. government today acknowledges the Americans at the U.S. compound in Benghazi were not adequately protected and says those who carried out the attack are still being hunted down. Just a few weeks ago, Abu Anas al-Libi was captured for his role in the Africa bombings, and the U.S. is still investigating what part he may have played in Benghazi. We've learned that this man, Soufiane Benkoumou, a former Guantanamo Bay detainee and longtime al-Qaeda operative, was one of the lead planners, along with Faraj al-Chalabi, whose ties to Osama bin Laden go back more than 15 years. He's believed to have carried documents from the compound to the head of al-Qaeda in Pakistan. The morning after the attack, Morgan Jones went back to the compound one last time to document the scene. He took these photos, which he gave to the FBI, and has published in a book he's written. After all this time, he told us he's still haunted by a conversation he had with Foreign Service Officer Sean Smith a week before the attack.
Yeah, he was worried. He wasn't happy with the security.
And you didn't tell him all your worries?
No.
Didn't want
to. I didn't want to worry him anymore, you know? He's a nice guy. Yeah, I sort of promised him he'd be okay. And
you think about that?
Every day, yeah.
The U.S. pulled out of Benghazi, and al-Qaeda has grown in power across Libya. When a member of our team went to the U.S. compound earlier this month, he found remnants of the Americans' final frantic moments still scattered on the ground. Among them, Ambassador Stevens' official schedule for September 12, 2012, a day he didn't live to see.
Go to 60 Minutes. You were listening to 60 Minutes report on Benghazi. Now, that's one piece of the puzzle. What does it tell us? It tells us that the people on the ground knew there was not security. They also, you hear about, there's two locations. There's the embassy, then there's the CIA annex. We don't hear about the annex. We only hear about the embassy and how it was a surprise, how it was a spontaneous mob that came based upon a film. That was an orchestrated PR campaign from the White House, from Ms. Rice, who had been a UN ambassador, from the President of the United States, all the talking points of all the experts, and from Hillary Clinton. Now we find out that they were lying. Let us go now to Larry Hancock out in Oklahoma. Larry's website is larryhancock.com. He is a highly respected investigative reporter, a U.S. intelligence, national security state expert, and he has written on the history of the CIA, political assassinations, religious extremism, terrorism, and also he is respected by the House Select Committee on Investigations staff and former historian for the CIA and the Defense State Department. Nice to have you with us, Larry.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Larry, you've researched and analyzed over 60 years of attacks on the U.S., from the Japanese invasion of Pearl Harbor through the Cold War, 9/11, and more recently, acts of terror. What is clear is that U.S. intelligence has almost always had sufficient evidence and prior warnings before these attacks. 9/11 is perhaps the clearest example of extraordinary neglect on this matter. And the large question is, why? What accounts for the largest intelligence, spy, and surveillance machine in the world with the most proprietary and advanced technology specifically designed to identify all the clues and evidence prior to a threat to have such a poor track record? And of course, average Americans are rapidly losing their faith in the government's national security mechanisms. And a study released this week shows that more Americans today fear guns in the hands of U.S. citizens than do terrorist attacks by foreign governments or organizations. And one major point that might account for this is that has been the dismal record in our intelligence agencies since 9/11 and subsequent acts of terror that these agencies failed to prevent. So first, before going any further, give us the other pieces of the Benghazi puzzle during Hillary Clinton's tenure at the State Department and address, for example, what was at the annex. We have heard that there might have been weapons there that were being shipped into Syria to the so-called moderate terrorists, the ones that John McCain thinks are very ethical and moral people that we should be supporting. And if that were the case, that would mean that we were in violation of international laws by, in effect, invading and having committed a war against a sovereign nation without a declaration of war. Is that the reason why the big secrecy and the lies around Benghazi? Your thoughts, please.
Yeah, the major part that's missing from the narrative about Benghazi is the CIA part. And if you look at all the congressional investigative reports, that's an area that Congress really did not explore at all for a couple of reasons. But the reason this complicates the narrative is, as in other occasions, CIA operations, covert operations, often use the State Department, aid, and other government agencies as covers. And basically, when that happens, to some extent, the State Department is exposed and, unfortunately, occasionally sacrificed to the CIA operation. An important thing about Benghazi to recall is that diplomatic post had largely been shut down over security concerns. There was only one diplomat there being rotated back and forth, so they'd absolutely minimized the staff. The security was as described in the audio you just played, and there was awareness of the threat. But the point being is that State Department mission was providing cover, diplomatic cover, for CIA officers, a large contingent, from what we hear from the security staff stationed at the annex, which was a not a diplomatic annex, but an operational CIA station. There were up to 20 CIA personnel there, protected by an extremely experienced and well-armed 10-man CIA security force. And they were there, had entered under diplomatic passports. So it's one of those high-risk situations where you're conducting a covert operation under State Department cover, and that complicates things immensely. I very much suspect one of the reasons the mission was being maintained in face of the known threat was that they needed that cover, even though they'd minimized it by virtually closing it down. And even at the time of the attack, the ambassador, who had not been there for a year, traveled by himself with one communications advisor, rotated back the diplomatic officer who'd been there, but he took with him a number of GRS, State Department security personnel for protection who were not routinely stationed there. So he even upped his own protection, the problem being that that protection was normally for his travels, for his appearances, for his meetings, for his travels throughout the city, and really didn't enhance the security. So the first response to your question is the fundamental story is obscure because of the covert mission that was going on. And the covert mission was probably threefold. We know that the Joint Special Task Force Trans-Sahara was operating in the area. They had officers in Tripoli. Some of the officers that showed up in Benghazi were from that group. AFRICOM, which is the army mission that's responsible for Libya and Africa, was operating drone in eastern Libya. And we know that there's a good evidence, as you mentioned earlier, that there was both an arms interdiction operation going on, surveillance of going on against the jihadis, and sourcing of especially Soviet-era weapons. There's the important point there is if you're going to supply deniable weapons to people in Syria, it needs to look like they're the Soviet weapons being captured from the Assad regime. And the only really good place to get those at that point in time was the Soviet weaponry that had been massively accumulated in Libya. So it's a complex operation. We're talking about a big operation, far larger than anything state was doing by itself. The other things that really complicates understanding it, of course, and this is something I've written about in my book on clandestine covert operations, is that by law, by laws that support the National Security Act of 1947-1948, literally, U.S. personnel, whether they're in the State Department or elsewise in the administration, are not legally able to answer questions. They literally have to either not answer questions or come up with different stories about covert operations. So if you look at the hearings that have been held, no one can ask the real questions. Even the people on the committees who are on intelligence committees that know can't say. They would be violating the law if they did, and the people that they're questioning can't talk about it either. So we have a very complex situation, but it's founded in the point that what was really going on was a massive covert CIA operations related to arms in Libya.
Let's go over this in a little more detail, because if, as you're suggesting, the ambassador had to keep a very low profile, if he suddenly had a massive group of security people at the embassy or any adjacent buildings, then the likelihood it would have drawn attention. And since Al-Qaeda, al-Nusra, yeah, and other groups in the area would have had infiltrators, people who they would have known rather quickly what was at hand. But by keeping a low profile, then it would have not given someone the impression that a massive intelligence operation under CIA that had dominance over the State Department, and the State Department was merely the front. So when they did this, A, look at the acts they engaged in, supplying weapons to terrorists, because the people that ultimately ended up with the weapons out of Benghazi to Libya ended up being terrorists. Now, it doesn't matter what you call them. The Syrian army deserters, that the new Syrian front or al-Nusra, there is no such thing. It's an oxymoron to say you have a moderate terrorist. That would be like saying you have a moderate rapist, a moderate slashing of the throat. No. Any act of aggression against other people who are innocent, you shouldn't support them on any level. And yet we were, but we have a history of this. Remember the Mujahideen in Afghanistan fighting the Russians? We supported them, we supplied them, we trained them. And in Charlie Wilson's war, it laid all this out.
Yeah, we have a very bad history of... Well, I guess the point is we never learn from that that experience, apparently, as you say, from Afghanistan. And, you know, this is not a statement that I would make lightly. One of the reasons that I think the ambassador was continuing such a low profile was we now know that a shipment, a ship, not just a shipment, a ship carrying large inventories of weapons sailed out of Libya to Turkey. Those weapons were destined to go into Syria. And we also know that the ambassador was meeting with some of the Libyans who owned that same shipping firm during his travel to Benghazi, or he was supposed to be meeting with them. And I think you make a very good point. The Al-Qaeda and the various jihadi factions knew this was going on. And when the Green Beret officer said this was a planned attack, it was an attack that was intended to abort and co-opt everything that was going on there. I won't argue that it was the wrong thing to be going on, but it was. It's another case where we tried to do something covertly, and it just never makes any sense. And it sets you up for not being able to explain it either, which is even worse because it makes you look doubly bad. But even I think in the tape that you played, there was a remark that the CIA security people, who were much better armed, they've written a book now, which is I'd recommend for reading. It's called 11 Hours, and they describe the fact that the CIA station chief actually held them back because his orders, and these would be CIA orders, not State Department orders, were that he was not to expose the annex, not to suppose his operations by putting his people out to respond to incidents. As a matter of fact, they recount that earlier in the year there had been other incidents where they could have responded, but his orders were to use the local Libya militia rather than them so as to not expose the CIA operation. Now, there's some thought that the State Department didn't fully understand to what extent those CIA folks were not a quick reaction team because they were trying to maintain their cover. That's a miscommunication, but it just shows you how tangled up you can get in these sorts of deniable operations.
Larry, let me try to put this into a larger context. We had zero individuals from either the Senate or the House Security Oversight Committees, which together represent over 40 people, ever in decades coming forward to the American people saying, I sit on a committee, I've reviewed information that our intelligence agencies are engaged in, and now we have 16 to 17 of these agencies, and I found that what they were doing was ill-conceived, illegal, breaking international or domestic laws, and should be stopped. We've never had such a thing. All we've had is some people saying, I'm concerned about what I've been exposed to. Or what have you been exposed to? I can't say. I'm committed by law not to say something. And then it reminds me of the FDA knowing full well for over 40 years that the ingredients in cigarettes could cause addiction and disease, keeping that private because of proprietary laws that they could not violate, and letting upwards of 10 million Americans die because of that. So I'm saying, if you know that the CIA has been engaged in illegal activities of having arms, light and heavy arms, given to Syrian rebels that are really Syrian terrorists, if you've engaged in destabilizing the Assad regime by so-called populist uprisings, which are really CIA front groups and as leading them, if you've engaged in effect, breaking the Nuremberg codes and other codes by engaging a sovereign nation in an act of war but keeping it secret, shouldn't we at least have someone in our government who has the courage to risk their own career to come forward saying, I'm going to expose this because it's the better good? And when we do have someone who exposes crimes like Edward Snowden, the entire Congress, seemingly, including Bernie Sanders and especially Hillary Clinton, want him arrested and want him tried. And people who are more voracious in their need for revenge, the neocons like Bill O'Reilly and others, want him jailed, or others want him killed. So you want to hurt the person that's telling you the truth and protect the people who are guilty of crimes against humanity. To me, that makes no sense. Your final thoughts on this?
You stated it well, and the problem is the oversight, the way it's constructed, doesn't work, because essentially those intelligence committee members are required by law to be briefed. Okay, now, they can't openly talk about what they've been briefed on, so their choices are threefold. They can push back to the president and say, this operation that you're conducting in Libya isn't right. We're going to pass legislation to stop you. We're going to defund it. We're actually going to do something. And that was the whole thought, was that Congress would have enough nerve to push back. They never have since the Iran-Contra affair. Or they can do something sneaky, like leak it to the press and take that risk. And they do that on occasion, which was not the point. The point was that they should take their responsibility and do it themselves, as you said, even if it requires some risk. They could go to the Justice Department. There are things that they do, but they don't do that. And because Congress doesn't do anything proactive, it falls back on these other people. And it really is honestly more gutless, because what they're doing then is complying with the law, which doesn't even allow them to... These things are compartmentalized at a high enough level, the details of the CIA operation, that they're not even going to be told that. They're going to simply be told that there is an operation. So if they don't push the issue, they couldn't even ask questions in a closed hearing. They could bring the right people into a closed hearing, and they wouldn't know enough to ask the right questions. And even in a closed hearing, the people that they're talking to are probably going to say, your clearance isn't sufficient. The whole thing is a construct that just isn't working.
Well, it's never worked. That's the problem, Larry. Larry Hancock, we're out of time. What I'd like to do is this. Invite you to come next week, next Tuesday night, for 1 hour to our Progressive Commentary Hour to discuss in depth the history of America knowing in advance, from Pearl Harbor to 9/11, that there was a crisis and not acting upon it to protect Americans. I'd like for you to join us to share your insights on that, all right?
Oh, I'd love to do that.
Great. Thank you, Larry. Larry Hancock, and he is considered one of the independent investigative researchers in the area of U.S. intelligence, national security, state. His website is larry-hancock.com. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on tomorrow's program. Have a nice day.